people have a lot to say about this. You've stirred up a very interesting pot. I really appreciate that. I would have liked to have said a few more things about exactly what Boris was talking about, who's also kind of behind the scenes in terms of the ideological roots of them, the American Lands Alliance, Storm Over Rangelands conference has just happened in Boise, Idaho, the ideological roots of the Oregon standoff, and so much more, but we have to end. So thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate your being with us.
Constitution, well, you know, they don't want to change your head. And that's an institution, well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman, Mal. Gonna make it anyhow. All right, all right, all right. All right.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street 3rd Annual Mardi Gras Festival, Tuesday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This annual celebration features the Les Blyke Mardi Gras films Dry Wood and Always for Pleasure, as well as food, costumes, music, and more. Again, that's the 3rd Annual Mardi Gras Fat Tuesday celebration, February 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Love somehow. I'm through
playing with fire. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO, at 9 on Political Perspectives, Karen James interviews Bob Jundeff of Disability Rights Oregon about an agreement with the Oregon Department of Corrections aimed at reducing isolation and improving the care of seriously mentally ill adults who are incarcerated. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, analysis of the results of the Iowa caucus, and author Nomi Prinz talks about the big money in the campaigns. And at 11, it's the KABU Bike Show. Thanks for listening to KABU, and thank members for your generous support. Now, coming up is Political Perspectives.
Good morning. This is Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Karen James. My guest is Bob Jundeff, Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. In January 2016, Disability Rights Oregon entered into a Memorandum of Understanding with the Oregon Department of Corrections. This agreement comes after an investigation by Disability Rights Oregon of the conditions in the Behavioral Health Unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Karen.
So, Bob, what is the work of Disability Rights Oregon?
DRO is a protection and advocacy organization, and that means that we get funded by the government, the federal government, to protect the civil rights of people with disabilities. And that includes people who are in institutions. Those could be mental health institutions or other types of disability-oriented institutions, and includes jails and prisons.
So, Bob, after your organization's investigation, the Oregon Department of Corrections, by signing this Memorandum of Understanding, has agreed to reduce isolation and improve the care of seriously mentally ill adults in their custody in the Behavioral Health Unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. Now, what is a Behavioral Health Unit?
Well, it's a place in the prison that is designed to house inmates who have serious and difficult behaviors that are associated with a mental illness. So it's an alternative to discipline, if you will. If a person is acting out as a result of their mental illness, they can end up in the behavioral health unit. And the way that they describe it is a, quote, intensive behavioral management and skills training service where mental health symptoms and cognitive functioning level contribute to maladaptive and high-risk behavior. Now, that's a lot of language that means that what they're trying to do, or what they say they're trying to do, is to bring down high-risk behaviors that are resulting from a mental disability.
And is the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem the only behavioral health unit in the whole Oregon prison system?
That's correct. The penitentiary is a very old building, over 100 years old, that sits in Salem. As our investigation report noted, a person literally has to walk through 11 secure doors in order to get from the front door of the penitentiary into the behavioral health unit.
And how many prisoners are we talking about in this unit?
There are actually three behavioral health blocks, and the most secure one has anywhere from 40 to 60 inmates in it.
And how many people with serious mental illness are in the Oregon prison system?
Well, the Department of Corrections estimates that upwards to 30% of their inmate population has a significant mental illness. And people who have the most serious mental illnesses are about 6 to 8% of the population.
And this doesn't account for people that have emotional issues and less serious mental illness, correct?
Yeah, as you can expect, in any group of people, and this includes inmates, is that they're going to have a range of psychological or chemical dependency issues. But the people who end up in the behavioral health unit are folks who have very serious mental health disabilities.
So this memorandum of understanding that Disability Rights Oregon entered into with the Oregon Department of Corrections, it followed an investigation. What prompted an investigation of the Behavioral Health Unit?
Well, a couple of things, Karen. We began in earnest working with the department in 2004 when they were completely revamping their mental health services. And part of that plan was to create a standalone mental health prison in Junction City. And that recognized that the facilities that the prison had were totally inadequate in order to house that group of people. The legislature decided not to fund that institution. And so what happened was that this unit was placed in the old Supermax portion of the penitentiary right next to death row. So this unit has continued for a number of years, and we've been watching it carefully. But in recent years, we were receiving more and more complaints from inmates and families that the conditions in the unit were subpar. We asked some legislators to go visit that unit, and they did. However, no action was taken. And so we decided to undertake a full-scale investigation of the unit. Our two attorneys, Joel Greenberg and Sarah Radcliffe, visited the unit, talked to inmates, talked to staff, and reviewed piles of records in order to understand what was going on in the unit. The result was our report behind the 11th door, which showed that inmates in that unit normally spent 23 hours a day in cells with very little opportunity for any type of recreation, that they received 1 hour of mental health treatment per week. And in order to get that treatment, they needed to be removed from their cell, put in shackles, and brought through a variety of doors to a small room where they were placed in a phone booth-sized metal cell. And when they were securely in that cell, then a mental health therapist would come in to talk to them for an hour. And that was once a week for those inmates.
And what other findings came of this investigation?
Well, one of the most troubling aspects of the unit was that as a result of this level of isolation, and remember, for people who are, for example, hearing voices or have very difficult time controlling their own emotions, that being isolated for 23 hours a day makes their symptoms worse rather than improving them, that people would act out. When a person is rendered totally powerless and isolated, that they may do things like put a sheet over the front of their cell or hurt themselves in order to get attention. And when those things would happen, the response from staff was to try to remove that individual from the cell. And oftentimes that occurred with staff in full riot gear having to conduct what's called a cell extraction, which is a very violent action in which the cell is opened, the inmate is rushed and brought out, and then placed in restraints afterwards. We were particularly concerned that these actions would be taken without first consulting mental health staff in order to see if there was a way to de-escalate the situation short of having to take these types of drastic actions. So our conclusion was the behavioral health unit had spiraled into a situation, I don't think through anybody's intention, but it had spiraled into a situation in which people who were housed there were not getting better, they were getting worse, that they felt hopeless, unable to see the day that they might get out. And this resulted in their engaging in behaviors that escalated the chance of violence. This is just an untenable situation.
Now, you say that there was no intention on anyone's part, or there was no real reason for this deterioration, but what do you attribute it to?
Well, in prison environments are bizarre environments. You have to start from that premise, and they're high security environments. People who work there don't want to get hurt. It's completely understandable. And when faced with a person with a psychiatric disability that staff member may not understand, they want to protect themselves sometimes at all costs, which means that, for example, keeping a person in a cell for 23 hours a day is a good way not to have to engage with that person and risk some type of harm. And so there's always balance that has to occur in a correctional mental health environment between therapy and security. And if the balance is too far in terms of security, then the therapy can be totally lost and become negative therapy, if you will, so that the person is in fact deteriorating rather than improving.
Did the Oregon Department of Corrections agree with your findings?
We presented our report to the Department of Corrections even before we released it to the public, and we began discussions about the terms of it. I believe that while they did not agree with everything in our report, they understood that the substance, the main substance of the report, was correct. I believe they also recognize that lawsuits have been brought around the country based upon very similar facts, and very routinely state departments of corrections have lost those lawsuits. So I think that the Department of Corrections had a sincere desire to improve conditions, but also they understood that it would be better for them to take action on their own rather than being forced to do so by a federal court judge.
It's surprising, with all of the information about the psychological effects of isolation, especially long-term isolation, and the recent lawsuit by the prisoners down in California and them winning their lawsuit against indefinite solitary confinement. President Obama just came out opposing solitary confinement for youth in the federal prison system. A lot of reports, even the United Nations, saying that 15 days of solitary confinement equals torture, that the Department of Corrections here in Oregon did not on their own take steps to care for these prisoners who have serious mental illness.
Well, I can't look into the thinking of the Department of Corrections, but I can say that solitary confinement has been getting more and more attention nationally. In Oregon, our Oregon Youth Authority responded to a bill brought by Representative Fredericks that would have banned the use of solitary. They responded by entering into a planning process in order to diminish its use and ultimately eliminate it. We've at Disability Rights Oregon have been participating in a work group that has been looking at that practice, and it's become pretty clear to us that that security staff have become reliant upon the use of seclusion for the reasons I stated earlier, that that it is a safe thing, they perceive it to be safe, a thing for them to do. And also a way to hold inmates accountable in their minds for certain types of behavior. Now, when those behaviors are really driven by mental health problems, you can see that this is not an effective way to hold a person accountable. So we're moving ahead, I would say, slowly, but it's something that needs to be done with the full cooperation, not only of the administrators of these facilities, but also the staff, in order for it to work properly. And while I and you and many of us would like things to change immediately, it does take time for staff to receive the training, support, and experience that they need in order to learn how to effectively deal with behaviors associated with mental illness. And so in our memorandum of understanding, a very important part of it is the recognition of the need for the department to obtain additional resources in order to increase the number of staff in the behavioral health unit and to expand its size. So we will be going to the legislature in February asking for $8.2 million in order to do that. Now, understand that allowing people out of their cells does increase the potential danger for staff. And so in order to address that, you need more staff, and you also need a larger space. The space that is available now for inmates in, in these behavioral health unit are very limited and very tight. So we need more space and we need more staff. And that is the way that everybody can be safe. People cannot benefit from mental health services unless they feel safe, and security staff cannot effectively participate unless they feel safe. So what we're really shooting for here, if that's the right word, is that we have a safe environment where people's mental health issues can be addressed so that their behaviors, that the behaviors that brought them there in the first place, can be managed and that they can return to a less restrictive environment within the correction system. And then ultimately, of course, back into our communities, because the vast majority of people in the prison system will be back in our communities. And we all benefit if they receive the mental health services that they need.
So Bob Jundeff, Disability Rights Oregon, the legislature will meet only for 1 month in 2016. Talk again about the legislation that you are seeking funding for during this short legislative session in 2016.
Sure. So our memorandum of understanding says that the Department of Corrections will make a good faith effort to have inmates in the behavioral health unit out of their cells for 10 hours of structured time and 10 hours of unstructured time. What that means is, by structured time, is that it's therapeutic activities, and unstructured means things like physical exercise, meals, phone calls, games, and that sort of stuff. So in order to achieve that, the behavioral health unit is going to need to have additional staff so that they have qualified mental health practitioners present for 13.5 hours a day, 7 days a week. That means that there is therapeutic services available pretty much at all times. And you have to understand, this is a recognition that the only way you get into the behavioral health unit is that if you have a very serious mental illness that is causing very problematic behaviors. So each of those patients or inmates slash patients will need to have an individualized treatment and crisis prevention plan. And in order to do that, there will need to be an expanded physical area in the behavioral health unit so that these activities can be safely provided. There needs to be staff training, both for correctional staff and mental health staff. Data will need to be collected to make sure that we see what direction things are going, if things are actually improving. We're going to have an expert involved. In fact, we already do have an expert involved, a Dr. Joel Dvoskin, who's a national expert. And in order to achieve these, we're going to need about $8.2 million in order to get that going. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the legislative process, because this is a short session. You know, Oregon has a two-year budget. And so in the short legislative sessions, the ones that happen on even-numbered years, it's only a month long, and it does not create a budget, because it's sort of midway through the budget. But what it does do is it looks at how the state is spending the money it does have, kind of can rearrange that money, and then looks at needs that they can draw from the reserve fund in order to fill. The committee in the legislature that does this is the Ways and Means Committee, and the Ways and Means Committee is broken up into subcommittees that look at their particular area. So what we will be doing, along with the Department of Corrections, is going to the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee and making the case that this is an important need and that the state should fund it, take money from reallocating from other services and look to the reserve fund in order to find sufficient money. So there isn't a particular bill. What it is, it will be a request for a budget alteration, if you will. One of the co-chairs of this subcommittee is Senator Chip Shields, who introduced legislation in the last session on this topic. He recognized that it was a problem, and he came forward with a bill to try to address it. That bill did not pass, but he is there, and he's quite knowledgeable about the problem. Other members of that committee from the Portland area are Representative Jeff Barker from Aloha, Representative Chris Corsick from Troutdale. So if callers want to voice their support for this funding, those are two legislators who sit on that key committee. And of course, Speaker Kotek. Tina Kotek is from Portland, and needless to say, she has a lot of influence on what happens in the legislature, and she would be a good person to contact as well.
Okay. Contact your legislators and urge them to support funding for the Memorandum of Understanding between Disability Rights Oregon and the Oregon Department of Corrections. And Bob, are you hopeful that the Oregon Department of Corrections will receive the funding that they need to implement some of these changes in the Behavioral Health Unit?
Well, I'm very hopeful that that will happen. The department seems optimistic, but of course, asking for money from the legislature is never a sure thing.
So what is the timeline then? Does the Department of Corrections then have a timeline in which they have to make these changes once the funding is received?
Well, one of the interesting things about our agreement, speaking as a lawyer, is that we did not go to court. And this agreement is really a voluntary agreement between our agencies. And so if we believe that the department is not moving forward in a reasonable fashion, we or any inmate is at any time proceed to court. And so while there are not strict timeframes placed on the implementation, we understand that we'll take some time in order to make these changes, and we will evaluate on an ongoing basis as to whether the department is working in good faith and whether the changes that they have promised are implemented. So stay tuned.
So how can people find out about all of this information? Your report, what is the name of the report again?
A report is Behind the 11th Door, and it and other documents, including the Memorandum of Understanding, can be found on our website, which is DROREGON, DR Oregon.
www.droregon.org.
Correct.
And that will be linked to the KBOO website. Bob Joondiff, Disability Rights Oregon, one more time, urge our listeners to contact their legislators.
This Memorandum of Understanding cannot work unless the department has the funding that it needs to implement it. That's $8.2 million. We urge listeners who care about how our prison system treats people with mental illness and other inmates to urge their legislators to support this funding.
Bob Joondiff, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kim.
Good luck with the Memorandum of Understanding and its funding. And thank you for all the wonderful work of Disability Rights Oregon.
Thank you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Political Perspectives, and I'm your host, Karen James. We have been speaking with Bob Joondiff from Disability Rights Oregon about the Oregon prison system. There are 36 counties in Oregon, and many have their own jail or detention center. What about treatment of persons with mental illness in these county correctional facilities? We'll continue our discussion of prisoners in the Oregon correctional system as we speak with family members whose loved ones spent time in solitary confinement in the Multnomah County Jail. They request to remain anonymous. Welcome.
Hi.
Tell us about your son. When was he diagnosed?
Our son was diagnosed when he was 19 years old, which was about 11 years ago. He was hospitalized a few times, became stable, was medication compliant, actually held some short-term jobs, did some job training. About 5 years ago, he stopped taking his medications and turned to cannabis and other street drugs as his drug of choice.
And what was your son's diagnosis 11 years ago?
It was a combination of schizophrenia, bipolar, or schizoaffective disorder. It's been a little bit hard to tease out the exact diagnosis, but it's in that range.
So you say that he was working and he was medication compliant when he was just diagnosed 11 years ago. What precipitated his involvement with the criminal justice system?
When he stopped taking his prescription medications, he became angrier and he was decompensating more often. He was using harder drugs, and he was angry about his situation, we believe. He was angry at us, and he ended up attacking us one morning and tried to break into our house.
And this was when?
This was about 2.5, 3 years ago.
Is that when he became involved with the criminal justice system?
Yes, it is. The police were called. We pressed charges, which engaged him in the legal system.
And what was your hope at that time?
We were hoping that the courts could compel him to a rehab program to help him deal with his drug usage as well as addressing his mental health issues in a more comprehensive approach.
And did that happen?
That did not happen. He signed agreements saying that he would, in lieu of going to jail, that he signed agreements saying that he would comply with treatment, that he would comply with prescription medications, that he would attend outpatient treatment, and he was under weekly supervision from the court.
So these were jail diversion type of programs that he was enrolled in Multnomah County, is that correct?
That's correct.
And they were unsuccessful?
They were unsuccessful. There were periods where he was a little bit more compliant, where he thought he was going to be released from the diversion program, but he got into trouble again, had a couple of short jail sentences for unrelated charges that ended up kind of resetting the clock for him. But he was noncompliant and kind of gaming the system and pushing the envelope as far as he could.
So he was not medication compliant at this time either?
He was not, no.
So the county did attempt to help him?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Did the programs and the services go as far as you felt or thought they should go?
Our frustration was that the threat that was held over his head was jail, and that didn't appear to steer him, you know, back into the program. He was confrontational, noncompliant, and had no interest at all in being in a rehab program, had no interest at all in having anything interfere with his drug usage, which at that point was mostly cannabis.
What would have worked at that point?
What we feel might have worked, and we can't say would have, but might have, would have been a little bit more intervention. Very rarely did we ever convince anybody to go to his home and try to talk to him there. He refused peer support, peer counseling. I don't know if, you know, just actively saying, well, you've refused it, but we're going to send somebody out anyway, might have been helpful to him. I don't know. At so many times, he just kept saying, I don't need the help. All I need is my marijuana. So, but I do believe that a more assertive approach to him probably could have been helpful.
So the county still allowed him to call the shots a little bit.
Well, that's what everybody seemed to say, too. He seemed to be directing his own program.
We had hoped that these diversion programs would be successful in having him go voluntarily to a rehab program. When that didn't happen, our further hope was that the justice system would have tools to compel him or take him to a facility that was locked, that would be able to provide treatment instead of jail. Our hope was that that kind of facility would be available. Unfortunately, the justice system doesn't have those tools, and the bar for civil commitment is so high that the judge ruled that out in his ruling.
What exactly is civil commitment?
Civil commitment is the process for the state intervening in the case of people who are unable to care for themselves, are a danger to themselves or others. And that process holds a very high bar because it talks about restricting people's civil liberties. Recent rulings by the courts have supported that high standard for commitment. However, in my mind, the bar is so high that people with mental illness that don't recognize that they are a danger to themselves are allowed to devolve and decompensate and live a life that's not very dignified.
And it leaves family members like yourselves totally helpless.
Throughout this whole process, we've been feeling very helpless. And we have been able to, I mean, we've taken classes at NAMI. We've been involved in the mental health field as volunteers since my son became ill. And we thought we knew some of the avenues that we could use to get help, but we just couldn't. He wasn't sick enough for a civil commitment. He wasn't sick enough, or he didn't commit as violent a crime as needed to be in the mental health court.
What about the court system, though? Your loved one was in the clutches of the courts and the criminal justice system. Do you feel that that should be removed when someone is decompensating, has a mental illness? How do you feel about the courts being involved?
I think it's probably necessary that the courts be involved, but not necessarily in a criminal prosecution.
Explain that.
Well, the situation that we face is that the avenue that we were seeking in our situation involved the criminal justice system, believing that there was a link to a path that would compel treatment. That linkage didn't exist. We were a little bit alarmed that it didn't exist.
But you said you were afraid of your son. He committed a crime. He was arrested. The courts became involved at that point. Why should we believe that our loved ones, simply because they're mentally ill, should have different services?
It's a matter of the goal, the end goal. If the goal is purely retribution, or if the goal is to make that person so uncomfortable that they don't recommit, then, you know, that's kind of the model of the punitive criminal justice system. In the case of individuals with mental illness, there's a lack of insight with the person. They simply don't believe that the long-term consequences are going to matter when compared to the impulsive behaviors that they're exhibiting.
Plus, they don't believe they're ill in some instances.
They physically don't believe they're ill. And research shows that it's not denial. It's a lack of the tools to recognize that they have a problem. They don't have the machinery in the brain to recognize that they're ill. They get angry and frustrated because they know something's not working, but they can't internalize it and make the kinds of insightful judgments that many of us expect in order to become self-actualizing and insightful and able to change their behaviors and change their thoughts.
And now they're facing a judge.
And the judge has a limited set of tools in the toolbox. The judge can look at them and say, there's a serious problem here, but I only have one tool, and that tool is incarceration. And the judges are frustrated. The folks in the jails are frustrated because they have been charged with these mental health issues that they aren't equipped for. And they are the default mental health treatment facilities, but they don't have the tools and they don't have the resources to perform that service.
And you as parents, how does that make you feel?
It's a feeling of helplessness, frustration. You want to help your child.
but it's just about impossible. You try every avenue that you can think of, and yet none of them work.
Let's talk about this recent incarceration in the Multnomah County Jail.
Well, he was non-compliant with his court-ordered treatment. And so his compliance coordinator went to bat for him and said, you do everything that you need to do on this list, AANA, drug rehab over at your behavioral health center, and in 60 days you will be done. And during that time, he did maybe three things. So he was back in court in May. And at that point, the judge said, you've done nothing on this. We're going to sentence you to jail to be released to an inpatient treatment center. And so he spent, I think, maybe 20 days in jail at that point. And he was told he would be released to a rehabilitation center. They had a car lined up, but it wasn't a secure car. So it was just transportation to a facility. He got out of the car, went home, had a warrant issued a few days later for his arrest. But that was during the summer, and he wasn't arrested until November when he was shoplifting.
So he was picked up shoplifting in November 2015?
Right.
They took him to the Multnomah County Jail?
Right. Okay. At that time, then, he did appear before a judge and was going to be sentenced. At that point, I was there also, and I tried to convince my son that he might have an option of going to this inpatient rehab facility, and he said he wouldn't go. He would rather go to jail, from what we could gather, than go to this facility.
Did he say why he would not go to the residential treatment facility?
Well, at some points he does say that there are people out there with a lot worse addictions than he has, and he doesn't really have an addiction, he says. And there are people out there who are using heroin and driving around and killing people with their cars, so why should he go to a rehab facility and take a bed away from somebody who is much worse off than he is? That's the kind of thinking he's using, because I think, as with any addiction, most times people don't admit that they have one. Maybe they, in his case, can't understand that it is an issue. And he still doesn't. He sometimes thinks he has a mental illness, but other times he thinks he's okay and all he needs is marijuana to solve everything.
They talk about hitting bottom. Has your son hit bottom?
There's core dissonance that I see in that whole notion. The world of addictions and mental illness often refer to hitting bottom. And they also refer to a model that says that the individual can't be helped until they take the steps to walk through the door themselves. It assumes the AA model that is basically biblically based, in my view. I'm not sure it's even been evidentiary, proven effective. But the notion that many of these folks are capable of walking through the door first, I think is a fallacy. I think it's a cop-out. I think it's a way for society to say they aren't interested in their treatment, so why should I be? It's a way for us not to care for them as a community.
And this is exactly what happened decades ago. We opened the doors of our psychiatric hospitals and released people from these hospitals because of the conditions in these terrible places. But there was a promise that there would be funding for our communities to take care of these individuals, and that promise was never kept. So we have many people on the streets not cared for. And here we are, family members, attempting to care for our loved ones, and the help is just not there.
The help is not there, and the excuse we make is wrapping this up in the flag of civil liberties. And I contend that letting someone die with their rights on is not the way a civilized society should deal with a brain disorder and an illness. we don't treat Alzheimer's patients the same way. We don't treat Alzheimer's patients who are unaware of their incapacity. We generally have tools to humanely take care of those folks as their capabilities are failing. But the mentally ill don't get the same treatment. The mentally ill don't get the same respect. I think we're shining a light on this lately. I think there's been a lot of conversation that we didn't hear 10 years ago about the conflation of mental illness and the criminal justice system and our jails and our prisons. I applaud what Bob Junduff did with Disability Rights Oregon in intervening and opening the conversation with, you know, I believe a positive result at the state prison level. The same conversation needs to be held with county detention centers where the same problems exist, but they don't have the tools, they don't have the resources to implement the same kind of agreement that has been negotiated with the state prison system.
I don't think they have the will to do it. From our experience when our son was in jail here in Multnomah County, it was very confusing, very difficult to figure out exactly what was going on, and it still is very confusing for me to figure out what happened while he was there.
And he did spend some time, I understand, in solitary confinement in the Multnomah County Jail.
Right. From what I understand, the path was he was incarcerated in, and I don't know all the right terms, so in the regular housing. And at one point when he was calling home, he was saying that he might even be able to get some work and then have work release time and get some time off his sentence. One phone call, I said something about, I thought he sounded really upbeat, but I was a little afraid because it was beginning to sound a little manic. And from further investigation now, I realized that at that point he was getting a bit manic, and it was the next day that he exhibited some behaviors that led to him being put into what they call segregated housing.
Describe segregated housing. Do you know what those conditions are?
That's a very difficult thing to ascertain. He was in general population initially. We thought he was going to be going into the work center to be able to be, you know, even given more freedom. I think in the general population, they are out of their cells for a few hours every day. For some reason, I think because he was becoming a little bit manic, he was put into the mental health unit. While he was in the mental health unit, he felt that a guard was staring at him. So he, for a while, had a towel over his head. He said the lights were bothering him. He then put a towel over the door, the window, and did not take it down when ordered to.
Did he tell you this, or did the jail?
I've had it now from both. He told me about putting the towel up there, and he did admit too, that he rang his emergency bell without responding. And from what I understand from the jail, it was annoying the people and taking them away from doing other jobs. I have been trying to figure out if at this point, he was in a mental health unit, if anybody from the mental health staff visited him. And I have to do a little more investigation there because the correction side of it doesn't have a record, and the only way I can get a record is to talk to the mental health side of it because they don't seem to talk a lot together.
Why do you believe that even though he was placed in a mental health unit, he did not receive the care you felt he should have gotten?
Well, he was in the mental health unit, and I hadn't heard from him for a number of days. So I called the mental health staff to find out what was going on, how he was doing. And the woman on the phone told me that they hadn't seen him lately. They didn't know how he was doing because he was in segregated housing. And I asked what that meant, and she said, solitary, you know, the hole. So when I heard that, I was greatly alarmed, and I said, well, when are you going to check on him to see how he's doing? He has a mental illness. And they said, well, they would be seeing him in about 4 days, at which time my voice was raised, and I insisted that they see him sooner than that, and they did see him that evening. And at that time, he had been in segregated housing for about 4 or 5 days. So on the night that our son, he was in the mental health unit and he was refusing to comply with removing the towel from the window and stop ringing the bell. So they told him they were going to move him to a higher level of the mental health unit, at which time he refused to roll up his belongings and get ready to go. And so at that point, from what I have discovered in my investigation here, they may or may not have called the mental health team to come in. I don't believe the mental health team came in to help de-escalate the situation. Instead, from my son's account, they sent 5 guards in to take him not to a higher level of the mental health housing, but to the segregated housing, at which point he was placed on what they call level 5 disciplinary. And level 5 means that, from what I understand, now I cannot find anything written on this. I cannot find the handbook that delineates what kind of treatment people in the segregated housing should be receiving. But if you're a level 5, you are allowed out of your cell 15 minutes a day, and you are in belly chains and leg irons. After he was in segregated for a few days, he had a hearing, at which point they said he has to stay at level 5. Then someone said, no, let's have another hearing, and they reduced that to level 4, at which point he could come out of his cell for 15 minutes a day without all the chains and irons and things. So from what I understand from conversations with sergeants who are investigating my complaint, 15 minutes a day outside of the cell is all these people get.
15 minutes a day is
torture.
Torture, yes. But going back to, you say on the phone, he sounded manic. He sounded paranoid. He felt the guard was staring at him. And then what they do is 5 more guards in riot gear come, and probably what Bob Jundeff was explaining in the previous half hour, this cell extraction takes place, which can be pretty violent and brutal, depending on how compliant. And if you can imagine someone already paranoid and manic, it's probably not a pretty sight.
No, and my son was tased during this time. That's what he told me. Now, I don't have verification from the jail system about that. All these details are very difficult to get because you have to make a public request for public documents. And one of the men I was speaking with didn't even know exactly how to take that kind of a request from someone like me. He said they usually get it through lawyers. So I was just asking for it because I wanted to find out what had happened to my son.
Well, it is a very frustrating situation to be in the dark and not knowing, you know, what's happening. But the real sad part about this is that all this time, when our son was visibly and obviously, you know, mentally ill and cycling, there was apparently no treatment other than a cursory look in by someone with a mental health title. There was no treatment visible while he was in jail, and there was no release plan. Once he was off probation, once he was out of jail, they opened the door, they swung it open, and it may have said, please don't come back, but there was an abdication. It was basically, this project's done. We're done with this now.
So his probation was revoked,
right?
Yes.
Because?
He served his jail term in lieu of it. And the judge said as much during the sentencing, that the diversion program didn't work, and fundamentally they're done with the project.
The judge basically said that our son had been non-compliant with any treatment, and they had tried everything, and he had not agreed to do anything or not agreed to do much, so they were done with it.
Nothing left in the toolbox.
Right. Well, when he was released from jail, he got what I consider to be, or I'm calling now, release with brochures. They give you brochures about what treatment you might be able to find on the outside. And, you know, they give you the phone numbers, et cetera. But as far as follow-up or anything, they're not doing it.
There was an interesting component to this as well. I was not in the courtroom at the time of that last sentencing because I feared that it would escalate the situation. It might make things worse for our son. But the judge kind of lectured our son and had heard my wife's plea for another shot at compelled lockdown treatment. The judge's response was to lecture our son and say, you know, you're going to have to make some decisions. Eventually, your parents are going to abandon you. I've seen this before, that eventually everyone's going to get tired of this and you are going to be alone and have to face this without any help. I found that while that may be true, I thought that that was yet another way for the court to use the threat of punishment and a miserable life to try to solve a mental health problem.
When we were done with a court hearing, the compliance coordinator gave us very strong advice not to allow our son the soft pillow to rest his head on, but to stop any kind of help with housing so that he could be on the street. At that point, he could then seek help, and that would, you know, coerce him into treatment, which, of course, I don't agree with. I mean, how many mentally ill people out on the street are, you know, signing up for treatment and diversion programs, et cetera? I mean, they're all sleeping under the bridges and freezing and dying, and that's not the solution to the problem. What we really need are more facilities. We need more rehab places, and we need more secure ones. I have heard of a few secure ones, but the bar to get into the secure ones is much higher than to get into jail. You can get into jail and be secure there, but you don't get treatment.
So how is your son doing right now?
Actually, he seems to be pretty stable. He's subdued. He was, as you can imagine, the day he got out was a day of up and down and exhausting for all of us.
What advice do you have for other family members or friends who have a loved one going down this path or already involved with the criminal justice system?
I think it's critically important that family members educate themselves. There are resources through NAMI to take classes that help family members understand the dynamics of mental illness and help folks understand how to separate the disease from the loved one and understand that what we are witnessing is a terrible, terrible disease and that the fundamental character of our loved one is not at fault for what's happening. There's a grieving process that we all have to go through. And we hold out hope, but we all have to recognize that there is a terrible loss we suffer as we watch what we thought was going to be a productive, happy life devolve into something that we just couldn't have imagined. But there are folks out there to help. There are other folks, many, many other folks that are sitting in our situation that are experiencing this as well and can help people understand that there's nothing constructive about blaming yourself, blaming your loved one. There are supports out there, and don't feel shame. Don't hide it. Advocate, normalize it, and try to make it part of the day-to-day conversation so that we can advocate and have a war on mental illness the same way we have a war on cancer or a war on the disease of the day.
The other thing that I would like to add to that is that I think it's important to know some other people who have suffered from a mental illness and have been in recovery and are doing well. And that gives us all hope for the future. We are involved with a group called North Star, which is a clubhouse which helps people in mental health recovery. And the people who are members there are just wonderful. And they will talk about, with very, you know, great honesty, they'll talk about their suffering, but what their lives are like now and how much they can progress. So I think it's important for all of us who have someone with a mental illness to remain hopeful, because I think that helps our loved one too. you know, when we let them know that it's going to be better down the road, then they can have some hope too. And that carries us all forward.
I want to thank my guests. I know you want to remain anonymous, but I'm hopeful that your being here today will help a lot of family members going through this with their mentally ill loved ones. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. You can listen to this show at kboo.fm/political perspectives.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. What? Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community.